Karma is a bozo. Live from Rose Library, it's Just a Minute.
Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, victimization, question mark. Welcome and thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Howdy, Timey. So right before we got started, Zach just said somebody stole his memory card.
Yes.
So we've already had a victimization.
We did.
As we are beginning to talk about victimization.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about crime and crime victims and victimization this morning. And this was a request from my father. So shout out to Dad.
Yes.
His reaction to the solitary confinement episode was, I want to hear about the victims. So today we're going to talk about them. So, Tommy, have you ever been the victim of a crime?
Yes. So, when you started with this question, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like I'm old. I have a lot of history to sort through. And I don't want to get into specifics, obviously, but I have been a victim of both violent and nonviolent crimes. Mm-hmm. I will say that more recently, I was the victim of identity theft, and all of my information, including my social security number, ended up on the dark web.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like web online victimization, cybercrime.
Yes.
It's kind of an emerging, but us kind of traditional criminologists, we don't.
Yeah.
I don't think I even thought about cyber victimization as I was putting this together.
And that's why we need to do a separate episode on it, but we won't really talk about that today.
Yeah.
We're going to get into more traditional ideas about victimization. Correct.
Yeah, for sure.
What about you? Victim of a crime?
Yeah. It was kind of a minor assault. You might remember this. This was several years ago when I lived in my old apartment here in Harrisonburg when I was a regular smoker of cigarettes.
Yes.
But I was out on my porch just enjoying a nice smoky treat. And my upstairs neighbor, just random, like I'd never had any interaction with him before, just stormed down and slapped me across the face.
Yes.
You know, like it wasn't a hard slap, so I wasn't like physically injured from that.
Yes.
But obviously that's kind of like a totally unpredictable type of thing.
And shocking.
And he also kind of exhibited some like paranoid tendencies. He accused me of like setting off a smoke bomb.
Right.
That
right.
would like annoy him all night long. And he said that I would like, which I never smoked in my house, but he said I would go in my bathroom and turn my bathroom fan on.
Yeah.
So the smoke would like blow up into his apartment. So, he was kind of like paranoid. Like that. But kind of thinking about, our victimizations and, kind of the consequences of that, let's talk a little bit more broadly about the impact of crime on its victims.
Yes, let's. So what is the impact of crime on victims? You were a victim of this, you know, relatively minor assault, but still.
Like emotional trauma. I mean, I didn't experience all of these, but like fear, shame. Like rage, I definitely did because I would just like sit and kind of like think about and stew about like the gall, like how dare he, and just kind of have like these revenge fantasies in my head, obviously that I never carried out.
Yes.
Feelings of being afraid, depression, and then there are trauma symptoms. So there are, emotions and then things like sleep disturbance, dreams, anxiety, and I definitely like had dreams.
Yeah.
About, I mean, it wasn't like, nightmare flashback type of movie things, but I would like dream about him for years afterwards.
It disturbed your sleep for sure.
Yeah. Number three, being the victim of a crime can lead to fear and feelings of unsafety. Victims might feel unsafe. They're more afraid. They're more afraid of crime. They're more afraid of future victimizations. And there's some research that shows, interestingly enough, that household crimes, things like burglary or vandalism, can be kind of more fear-inducing than personal victimization.
Right.
So, like, if somebody breaks into your house or, vandalizes your house, it's kind of like attacking your place of safety. You don't feel safe in your own house. Yeah. And that was something. I was on my porch and he came down and attacked. And, like, when I would hear his footsteps, like, walking on my ceiling, I would just kind of get this, triggering. Like, feeling of anxiety.
Yeah, your home is your castle, per our last episode.
Yep. And sometimes victimization can lead to isolation and withdrawal. So definitely. Victims might, you know, be mistrustful of others. They might withdraw from social life, from, you know, hanging out with people. They might, you know, isolate themselves. Particularly studies show that victims are more mistrustful of society, of the police, right. of the court system, particularly yeah. if they were not helpful. Being the victim of a crime can also create a greater risk of re-victimization. So yes. your initial victimization can create factors or circumstances that might put you at risk of being a victim again in the future. And we can think of things like maybe like stable lifestyle exposure type of yes. thing. So if you do things in your life that, you know, may put you more at risk of being a victim,
right.
and, you know, things like where you live, who mm-hmm. you associate with, who you hang out with, and we're going to talk about like yeah. the victim offender overlap in a little bit, but
yes.
those, you know, those things can be risk of repeated victimization, and then your response to the
right
victimization. So like if you're afraid, some people may do risky things like drugs or alcohol or going out to bars or other
yes.
risky things to kind of cope with the feelings of victimization, and that can
yes.
kind of put you at risk of being yeah. a victim again or make you a more suitable target. And then victims might also, you know, kind of question themselves and their place in the world. They might have low self-esteem. They might believe that they deserved what happened to them.
Right.
And this is oftentimes, you know, kind of accompanied by or explained by what we call the just world hypothesis.
Correct.
And that's the idea that life events and circumstances are dictated by justice and fairness. And it's kind of like this notion of karma, that good things happen to good people
right.
and bad things happen to bad people. So a
yes.
good example of that, the way that we're tempted to think, is that people who are successful, they worked hard, they
yeah.
earned it, they deserved it. And people who are not successful, they're lazy and,
right.
you know, no good bums and such. Like, if you are successful, you're good,
yes.
and if you're not successful, you're bad.
Yes.
And so to put that in the context of victimization is obviously a bad thing when people are victims of crime. That's bad.
Right.
So we kind of try to explain that by something bad happened to somebody, so maybe they are bad or they've done something bad
right,
to
right.
deserve it. So why do you think that we are tempted to view the world this way?
Yeah, so this blaming the victim is linked to the just world hypothesis, but to be clear, victim blaming is a natural psychological reaction to crime because we have a very strong cognitive need to believe that the person must have done something to deserve mm-hmm. it. It helps us feel safe. It makes the world seem predictable, so reduces what we might call existential anxiety about mm-hmm. our place in the world, gives us a sense of security. I'm a good person, so bad things won't happen to me. And we just want an explanation for why this mm-hmm. happens. And this provides an easy and convenient mm-hmm. one, that you must have done something to deserve it.
Yeah, so it, you know, it kind of, like you said, helps us make sense of the world. It
yes.
helps us organize things. It makes us feel safer because I haven't done anything wrong or bad. I'm a good person, so I don't need to be afraid of being
right.
a victim.
Right.
And you mentioned victim blaming also, which is kind
yes.
of a separate thing from just world hypothesis,
it
but
is.
Kind of stems from that.
Yeah.
But we have seen that a lot of times, you know, we tend to not believe victims.
Yes.
Or we tend to blame them. And this is particularly prominent when there's a gendered element to crime. So
absolutely.
If we think about things like sexual assault or intimate partner violence, spousal
yes.
abuse, or sex worker victimization, we hear these kind of scripts that, you know, she deserved it, she brought it on, she was dressed a certain way, she was drunk, she
yes.
was flirty, no means yes, all of these things that kind of put the blame on the victim
yes.
instead of the aggressor, if we believe
right.
her to begin with.
Right, and we see that not just from the public, but also from criminal justice actors in the legal system,
mm-hmm.
which is hugely problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of quantity, how much victimization occurs?
Well, that is an interesting and difficult question. So,
measurement, we love to talk about
it. Oh, yeah. When I used to teach measurement and research methods, I would actually like bring a ruler and hold it in my hand with me in class that day. But we might be tempted to answer that question by looking at police reports or arrests, but that's
right.
not a good way to try to find out about crime victims, is it?
And it is not, because as we know, most crime goes unreported to the police. So therefore, it never ends up in our official records. And none of the crimes that I have ever been a victim of have I ever reported. And that's common.
Yeah, same. I mean, I didn't call the police on my neighbor that
slapped
me across my face.
Yes.
So very right, very true. And research shows us that more than half of crime that happens doesn't get reported to the police.
Right.
And there's a little bit of relationship between crime severity and reporting. More serious crimes tend to get reported more frequently.
Yes.
But still, you know, the vast majority of crime goes unreported. And I think we might have talked about this in our intro to criminology episode.
Maybe we did.
The dark figure of crime.
The dark figure of crime.
But anyway, the point is that, you know, official data, arrest data don't really tell us much about, or don't tell us as much as we would like to know about victimization.
Right.
Criminologists have the NCVS, not the NCIS.
My mom loves that show.
I have never seen a single episode.
Oh, my gosh.
So I don't know if it's good or bad, if it's on the spectrum of, like, Law and Order or...
Well, it's the Naval...
Criminal Minds.
It's a little Criminal Minds-ish.
CSI, Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
But NCVS, not NCIS, stands for National Criminal or National Crime Victimization Survey. It's conducted by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is the research arm of the DOJ.
The Department of Justice.
Department of Justice.
You're going to have to, you know, say these acronyms.
Well, I mean, I feel like the DOJ is, like, so much in the news all the time. People know what
But our number one fans would probably not know if you say DOJ what that stands
Don't
for.
Don't be insulting their fans.
I'm not insulting our fan base.
JK. But anyway, it's the NCVS is a national household survey. Researchers select households, ask people if they've been the victim of a crime, ask them about the characteristics of their victimization and the perpetrator, and whether they report it to the police, which is how we know about the dark figure.
Correct.
Through the NCVS.
Yes.
So 2021 is the most recent year for which we have NCVS data.
Yes.
And you can access this online. So you just Google NCVS. It's all online, annual reports. But here's some interesting tidbits about criminal victimization in 2021. So victimizations have been on a downward trend since the mid-1990s. Since 1993, violent victimization rates have decreased by 80%.
Correct.
In 2021, 2.7 million people experienced violent victimization, and that's a lot of people.
Like
almost 3 million people.
Yeah.
But that's less than 1% of the U.S. population.
Smaller than the population of Kentucky, my home state as well.
Wow. 11.7, almost 12 million people experienced a property victimization, much more common than violence.
Right.
In 2021, 46% of violent victimizations were reported to police, so less than half of people who were the victim of a violent crime reported it to the police.
Who is most likely to be the victim of a crime?
Well, we talked a little bit about this in our true crime episode. But, you know, our perceptions of who is most likely to be a victim is oftentimes inaccurate.
Yes.
So in my intro to crime and criminal justice class, I do this exercise where I say, okay, let's play win, lose, or draw. You remember that game show, win, lose, or draw?
Sort of.
Yeah, it was like a TV game show.
Yeah.
But it's basically,
sounds familiar,
it's
but
basically
I don't remember
Pictionary.
Seeing it. Yeah, I don't remember seeing it.
Anyway, my students don't remember that either. I used to watch it a lot.
If I don't remember it, I'll get
it. It was like 80s. Well, I'm younger than you. 80s,
yes,
90s.
So I should definitely remember it. I just don't.
But anyway, so, finally I said, somebody's like, well, what's win, lose, or draw? And I'm like, you don't know what that is? Finally somebody says, it's like Pictionary. So Pictionary, you know.
Yeah.
I say, imagine you're playing Pictionary.
Yes.
And the thing that you're trying to draw is a crime victim or a victim. So I have all of my students like
draw
a crime victim with the idea in mind that they're trying to get somebody to to guess it.
Okay.
And I've gotten some pretty good and funny drawings over the year. Probably my favorite one I've ever got, a student like drew themselves taking an exam with me, like standing over the desk, and they were saying like they're victims of taking my exam. So that was a pretty good one. But they like to draw stick figures. They like to draw violent crime a lot. A lot of times, like women and the elderly, if there are gendered elements beyond just a stick figure.
Right.
But there's a general perception that women and the elderly are frequent crime victims.
Yes.
And what say you to that?
Well, I say the media. And also listen to our episode on true crime, because the impact of media and true crime on public perceptions of who constitutes a crime victim, it's super powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, if you think that all of the serial killer victims are, you know, sort of white women, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. then yeah, it makes sense that people think that, but yeah, that's where we get our notions about who victims are.
And in reality, women are less likely than men to be the victims of crime.
Yes.
Particularly excluding certain gendered offenses like sexual assault and intimate partner violence.
Yes. Those,
primarily against women, but overall general crime trends, men are more likely to be the victim of a crime than women. Young people are much, much more likely to be the victim of a crime than the elderly. So basically, once you hit, let's say, 30, for men, your risk of being a victim drops in proportion to the length of hair that's growing out of your ears and down the back of your neck.
Yes.
So like for me in particular, I think my hairline is just like dropping down my scalp and down the back of my neck. So it's in proportion to my risk of being a crime victim. For women, what would you say?
Well, I don't want to, there's nothing I think I could say that's appropriate for the podcast.
I saw you deleted my comment.
Delete your comment because I did not think it was appropriate. But I will say that even though I know as a criminologist, obviously my risk drops significantly, my fear about crime has, interestingly enough, increased. And maybe it's because I feel like, you know, like I'm older, I'm not as strong, I couldn't fight off an offender, I don't remember Tang Sudo. I would not be able to.
I can't even pronounce that, let alone remember.
I would not be able to defend myself. And these are all the reasons why I asked for a crossbow from you for my birthday this year.
Don't mess with Thymie. She's going to stand her ground with a crossbow.
Right. I definitely had Daryl from Walking Dead in mind when asking for that weapon of choice. Yeah.
So women or men and young people more likely to be the victim of a crime. People of color, particularly black people and American Indians or indigenous folks, have very high rates of victimization compared to white people. Poor people have substantially higher victimization rates.
Yes.
Again, as income increases, the rate of victimization drops substantially.
Right.
And those are all, kind of demographic characteristics that are presented in the annual reports. This isn't included in the yearly NCVS reports, but data collected through the NCVS also show that LGBTQ individuals have very high rates of victimization.
Yes, and they're on the rise as well. Mm-hmm.
So gay and trans folks rate or risk of victimization is about 2 to 2.5 times higher than the general population.
Yes.
In these stats and, you know, kind of trends, correlates are remarkably stable over time. So what do you make of that? That young, poor people, men of color, most victimized group demographically, and how that aligns with what the public thinks of as crime victim.
Yeah. So definitely, sort of call back here to the impact of media and true crime on public perceptions. Mm-hmm. But sort of also relating this to our previous episodes, remember that these were the demographics of Dahmer's preferred victims. Mm-hmm. In media and crime studies, these victims are referred to as the quote unquote less dead because people care less about their murders or their victimization. Mm-hmm. So marginalized folks are invisible, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yes, yes.
And a related notion is what criminologists call the victim-offender overlap. I mentioned this before, and it's received increasing attention recently in criminology. And some criminologists even call it a criminological fact, which in social science is pretty rare.
Yes.
It's kind of equivalent to the age-crime relationship, one of the most strongest, consistent statistical associations that we see in the criminology of social science. And that's the idea that the same people, same individuals who are victims of a crime are also most likely to be committing crime and vice versa.
Yes.
And
tell me more about this victim offender overlap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it's a pretty strong relationship. It's not, studies show that it's not situational. It's found in, all data in all places. It's not tied to predictors of crime.
Right.
So it's not just that, the same correlates that predict victimization predict offending, but even atypical offenders and victims, we still see this offending overlap. So it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're black or white. We still see that the same people that commit crime are most likely to be victims, and vice versa.
Yes. So explain this.
Well, there are two major explanations for this. And one is kind of like the lifestyle factor that we talked about before. So people who commit crime hang out with other people who commit crime, and they're the most exposed to victimization. So like you hang out with a group of, you know, antisocial peers, escalation of mutual disputes. So you get in a fight, somebody's going to be the victim and somebody's going to be the offender at the end of that. Somebody's going to get hurt worse than the other. So people who commit crime tend to hang out with other people who commit crime or delinquency. Yes. And so that it's like, you know, closest access, greatest opportunity.
Yeah.
And then there's also the kind of risk taking behavior, or as we call it in criminology, lack of self-control.
Right.
So risk-taking behavior is associated with, you know, committing crime. You're more likely to take risk. You're more likely to commit crime. You're more likely to take risk. You're more likely to be the victim of a crime. And this, you know, this kind of is an interesting side note correlation, but one of the famous criminologists found like a strong predictor between being the victim of a crime and getting in a traffic accident. So if you're a victim of a crime, more likely to be a traffic accident.
Yeah.
And it's kind of explained by this risk-taking behavior.
Right.
You know, take more risk, you drive faster, you're more likely to get in a car accident. Take more risk, you're more likely to commit crime and be the victim of a crime.
Yeah, that's what we you know, we would say that those two things are being caused by something else.
Yeah, risk-taking is causally antecedent. Yeah. The statistical criminological term to these other two spurious relationships variables.
Yeah, because if not, we might say, you know, like people would say, oh, you're saying that, victimizing or being the victim of a crime causes traffic accidents. That's not what we're saying here.
Well, it could.
It could, actually.
I mean,
actually,
if you're driving when somebody punches you across the face, like,
but I mean,
that's not what we're talking about.
No, but sort of to relate the risk-taking behavior aspect, like I often talk to my students about, you know, who's a victim and who's a criminal, and how many times have you been at a college party where a fight has broke out and there's been an assault and nobody called the police, even though a crime took place.
Yeah.
But they would never, you know, sort of conceptualize the victim and offender in the same way in that scenario like we do with other types of situations of crimes.
But I always say this when I, you know, talk about this concept in class, and I think it's important to note this here. None of that is to minimize the harms of victimization or to blame victims. There's a difference in kind of like responsibility and explanation. We're explaining this relationship. We're not putting the fault of a crime or victimization on the victim. But it kind of goes back to the just world hypothesis. So I think that when you know, for example, a lot of people are concerned about quote unquote justice for the victims.
Yes.
They're thinking about this kind of good, bad, us versus them, good and evil dichotomy of bad criminals and good, innocent victims. And this is my, you know, full disclosure, personal opinion. It seems like that kind of language is more about punishing the bad people than it really is a true concern for victims, because as we've discussed, we tend to blame victims, not believe victims, not be concerned about the victimization of marginalized people.
Right.
And, you know, I would argue that oftentimes we use victim as a means to an end to kind of feed this retributive impulse.
Yeah.
And the real needs and concerns of victims often go neglected.
Yeah. So our desire to see punishment, right? Sort of.
We kind of crouch that in terms of like, but what about the victims? But that's
but we don't really care.
Not really what it's about.
Yeah.
And if you think about the traditional criminal justice process, it really does very little practically for victims. I mean, you know, we might think of kind of this abstract notion of like punishing the offender makes the victim feel safer, gives them like a sense of closure or safety. But, you know, it doesn't like do anything really to, you know, compensate or repair or fix anything that we went wrong. But in contrast to that, we have the idea of restorative justice. You want to talk a little bit about
justice? Think about punishment as sort of a state administered, you know, resolution to the situation. And so when we talk about restorative justice, we first want to mention that the person considered to be the grandfather of restorative justice, Howard Zaire, has an institute here in Harrisonburg as part of the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding at Eastern Mennonite University. And we, being the Gandhi Center, we also gave Howard Zaire the Global Nonviolence Community Service Award in 2013 for his foundational work on RJ, restorative justice.
Congratulations.
Nice. That was that. Can you believe that was a decade ago? No. I'll link to this as well as Howard's book in the show notes. But to begin, restorative justice is in contrast, as you said, to retributive justice, which focuses on the punishment of the offender. So I'm just going to give you like the Cliff Notes version. Mm-hmm. Restorative justice became popular in the 1970s as a way to shift the focus in the legal system from the offender to the victim. So restorative justice can include restorative or circle processes. And this sometimes is an encounter between mm-hmm. a victim and an offender. And that's probably yeah. what most people like think of. It's mm-hmm. like you put the victim and offender in the same room in a circle and make them talk to one another. Mm-hmm. But it's actually a lot more than that. So yeah. Howard says that restorative justice asks these questions to determine if something is actually restorative.
You know, a lot of times when I'm talking about this in class, I kind of hear the objection that like, it's not good to have victims confront the offender right. or vice versa.
Right.
But one of the like absolute preconditions is that everyone has to kind of consent. So nobody's yes. being forced to participate.
Correct.
In this against their will.
Yeah, especially the victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, for sure.
Yeah, if they don't want to confront their offender, they don't have to.
Yeah, and nobody advocating for restorative justice would
no.
like advocate for that. But yeah. it does, it centralizes the victim, it emphasizes offender accountability, and ideally the outcome of restorative justice would be do the offender, like you said, taking accountability and then making some steps to
yes.
repair, address, fix, restore the harm that they did through
yes.
the crime.
Right, the offense. Right, right.
And research shows that victims of crime are much, much more satisfied with maybe I added one too many much, but they're more satisfied.
They are more satisfied
with restorative justice processes yes. than with traditional criminal justice. So victims say that they feel better, they feel more satisfied, they get more out of a restorative yes. justice process than a typical criminal trial.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, to close our show, then it's our minute to spin it, where we give our 30-second takeaway from
yes.
today's episode. So, Timey, what is your spin?
Okay,
in a minute,
I'm going to give one of the most helpful pieces of advice from that which we receive from the JMU security training that we have to go through and change our password every 90 days.
Oh, I was about to say every other week or the other day.
But this is true. Mm-hmm. A hard-to-remember password that is written down is better than an easy one to remember that could be cracked. Mm. You don't want to be in my position where you have to pay $25 a month to lock your credit because of all your information ending up on the dark web.
Yeah, true, for sure.
Ben, what's your spin?
Well, I'm going to channel my inner Porky Pig and say that karma is a bozo. Like how I censored myself. Man.
Yeah.
So, you know, to sum up, victimization's traumatic. It's
yes.
not good. But like most things, it's more complex than good versus evil.
Right.
Good versus bad. But with a greater emphasis on things that we talked about, like restorative justice, we can center victims.
Yes.
We can do more than just pay lip service to those who've been harmed by crime.
This podcast is sponsored by the Gandhi Center at JMU, which relies on support from generous donors like yourselves. If you would like to throw a few bucks to the Gandhi Center to support our educational programming, please click on the link in our show notes. Send justice topic suggestions via DM on IG at Gandhi Center JMU, or you can tweet at us or DM us on Twitter at Just A Minute Pod.